I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Dina Rabban, CEO of the new Jewish YouTube channel, Unpacked. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and our Shinshiniot, Young Representatives of Israel, Rotem Rappaport, and Ron Benicote. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. This is the final Two Jewish show of the month of June. It is, after all, the last day of June, which means this coming Thursday is the 4th of July, American Independence Day. That makes this a good time to remember the role that Jews played in the American Revolution back in 1776 and during the 7 years of the War of Independence that created our country. We could, of course, extend this discussion throughout the rest of American history, but as long as we're on the subject of the 4th of July...
I'm singing you the ballad of a great man of the cloth. His name was Harry Lewis, and he worked for Irving Roth. He died while cutting velvet. On a hot July the 4th. But his cloth goes shining on.
Glory, glory, Harry Lewis. Glory, glory, Harry Lewis. Glory, glory, Harry Lewis. His cloth goes shining.
Harry Lewis perished. In the service of his Lord, he was trampling through the warehouse where the drapes of Roth are stored. He had the finest funeral the Union could afford, and his cloth goes shining on.
Glory, glory, Harry Lewis. Glory, glory, Harry Lewis. Glory, glory, Harry Lewis. His cloth goes shining on.
That was the immortal late great comedian Alan Sherman's incredible The Ballad of Harry Lewis, including one of the greatest puns in the history of parody. He was trampling through the warehouse where the drapes of Roth are stored. Funny take on American patriotism as viewed through the lens, or perhaps it's the curtains, of the Jewish prevalence in the garment industry. Anyway, back to the deep and positive involvement of Jews in the earliest stages of American history, the Revolutionary War and the creation of the United States. In a way, this seems like a more important subject to reflect on now than it has been for some time. We Jews have long viewed America as a unique nation of opportunity that guaranteed religious freedom from its founding. And we have flourished here in the United States as much as we have ever done in any nation during our very long history as a people. After suffering religious persecution at the hands of governments all around the world for literally thousands of years, it has been our privilege to enjoy true freedom here in America. We've been blessed by the ability to create thriving, vibrant American Jewish life from colonial times up till today. America has truly been a golden land of acceptance and opportunity for Jews in so many ways for such a long time. But lately, there has been an unexpected and ugly rise in anti-Semitic activity here in America. This has been especially true over the past couple of years. We have seen it embodied in evil actions, such as two murderous synagogue attacks in the past 9 months. We have seen it paraded by very bad people on the streets of Charlottesville and elsewhere, and we have heard it and read it in the vile language of anti-Jewish propaganda that infests the internet and crawls into the speech of both open and closet anti-Semites. Jewish-oriented news feeds like JTA and The Forward and the Jerusalem Post and Haaretz and the Jewish Journal all cover anti-Semitic acts and comments regularly. I counted the stories in JTA that used to be the Jewish Telegraphic Agency. It's basically a kind of wire service style news feed of Jewish stories from America, Israel, around the world. Yesterday, half the stories in the section on the U.S. were about anti-Semitic statements, votes, tweets, and the actions being taken. Half the stories. You know, it's not that anti-Semitism is a new feature of American life. There have always been those who hated Jews for being different, for not being the same as they were in religion or lifestyle or priorities. And there were always subtler anti-Semitic biases that rooted themselves in institutions, excluding Jews from colleges, from professions, locking us out of certain businesses and industries in America, and clubs and hotels, of course. And there were quotas that allowed only a few Jews in. But over time, and with action, these barriers gradually broke down, and the acceptance of such biases diminished steadily. In truth, there is far less anti-Semitism in America today than there was 50 or 60 or 70 years ago. Far, far less. Still, you would have to have been in an isolation booth for the last 4 years to have missed the fact that there has been a decided upturn in anti-Semitic crud over the last few years, including public displays of hatred and awful acts of violence and murder, which makes it important to address this recent awfulness by noting that a substantial piece of it is rooted in a lie. The Jews are somehow un-American, that we haven't been part of this nation since it began. The truth doesn't always set you free, of course, but a dose of it sometimes helps cure evils. And the simple, plain facts are these. There have been Jews in America since colonial times, and we have always been active participants in the creation of the institutions that make this country what it is. At the time of the American Revolution, 1776 to 1783 or so, there were very few Jews living in what became the United States. Out of a total population of perhaps 2.5 million people, there were 1,500 Jews sprinkled around the 13 colonies. But there were active synagogues in Philadelphia, New York, Boston, Newport, Rhode Island, Charleston, South Carolina, and elsewhere. And about 150 Jews served in the American Army, Washington's Army, 10% of the total Jewish population, about 20% of the men. That is higher than the proportion of non-Jews serving in the American armies. There were about 230,000 total soldiers out of that 2,500,000 population, about 9%, and about 18% of the men. Anyway, the first Jew ever elected to public office in America, a man named Francis Salvador, was also one of the first patriots to die in battle for the Revolutionary armies. He was a representative from South Carolina, killed August 1st, 1776, fighting the Cherokees, who were allies with the British. A number of other Jews served in the patriotic cause and achieved prominence fighting the British, including Mordechai Shiftal, David Franks, and Uriah P. Levy, who later became the first Jewish commodore in the U.S. Navy and the savior of Thomas Jefferson's Monticello home and estate. Famously, Chaim Solomon helped finance the colonial cause and the Patriot Army during the darkest days of the war, and he personally loaned most of his own funds to impecunious founding fathers like Thomas Jefferson and James Madison. Jews have been deeply involved in the development and flourishing of America from its first days. We were actively involved as dedicated patriots throughout the formative period and through every development and crisis in U.S. history. During every major military conflict, we Jews have volunteered in higher numbers than our proportion of the population to defend our country. This has been true of us, whether we were born here or moved here and adopted America and were accepted by her. Without going any more deeply into American Jewish history, the facts are that Jews have been part and parcel of the fabric of American life throughout our nation's 243 years of existence this week. We have and remain deeply patriotic Americans in the best sense of that word, seeking always to see our nation live to its highest standards, guaranteeing life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness to its citizens, seeking to light the lamp of justice and freedom of conscience and expression for our own people, but mostly for the whole world. We Jews are proud of being an integral part of this compassionate nation that welcomes all who come here seeking opportunity, who embrace the values that have made America a magnet for the bright, enterprising, and capable people of this planet. To play us in this morning of just before the 4th of July, here's a musical setting of a poem, famous mostly for its location. The poem was by Emma Lazarus, a Jewish woman of Sephardic descent. The music by Jewish songwriter Irving Berlin, born Israel Balin in the Belarus section of what was then Russia. The poem is on the pedestal of the Statue of Liberty in New York.
Brazen giant of Greek fame, with conquering limbs astride from land to land, here at our sea-washed sunset gates shall stand a mighty woman with a torch, whose flame is the imprisoned lightning, and her name, Mother of Exiles. From her beacon hand glows worldwide welcome. Her mild eyes command the air-bridged harbor that twin cities frame. Keep, ancient lands, your storied pomp, cries she with silent lips. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore.
Send these,
the homeless,
send these,
the tempest tossed, send these,
the homeless.
That was Emma Lazarus and Irving Berlin's Give Me Your Tired in honor of the 4th of July this coming week. Our guest this morning is Dina Rabban, CEO of the first Jewish YouTube channel, Unpacked, which explains Jewish issues, ideas, and history in well-presented YouTube programming. Meet her and find out why this is the way young people learn Judaism today. When we return in a moment, here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town, amazing dining, and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the Soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome the Two Jewish. Our guest this morning, Dina Rabban, is the CEO of a brand new YouTube channel. It's called Unpacked. It's about Judaism. And in fairly brief videos, it explains everything you might ever want to know about Israel and, in a way, about Judaism. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Hi, Rabbi. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. So what led you guys to start this YouTube channel?
Well, I'm the CEO of a media company, an educational media company called Jerusalem U, and we decided to launch a new brand with a new channel called Unpacked, but we've been around for almost 10 years.
So, in a way, it's kind of a rebranding?
Well, I wouldn't call it a rebranding as much as a launch of a new brand. It's not uncommon for media companies to make decisions that they need to better meet and serve the needs of whatever market that they're looking to serve and to launch different brands and products to be able to do that. And that's exactly what we did. We were looking at our mission, you know, our goal at Jerusalem U, the media company, is to strengthen the Jewish identity, the connection to Jewish identity and to Israel of target audience of 13 to 34 year old young Jews. And we look carefully at how they're learning and living and being entertained. And we made a decision that this was the right time to launch something new.
You know, it's funny. When I type in, you know, certain letters into my search engine, the first one that always comes up is YouTube. And I'm not so young, so I have a funny feeling that you're going to reach a lot of people who are not just your target demographic, but certainly for younger people, concise, video-oriented programming is the best way to explain things, isn't it?
Absolutely. YouTube is the number one social platform for young people, and I say young people with quotes because really it's the number two search engine, you know. It's owned by Google, so
right.
People are either they're either Googling something
or YouTubing.
Or they're YouTubing.
Right.
Exactly, and you know certainly it's the first destination for young people whenever they're looking. It's essentially become their encyclopedia, their library. It's their virtual learning space.
What has been the single most popular video that you guys have run?
Ooh, that's a really good question. So you know we launched. I think we're up to the 25th episode of a new series. So the channel launched recently, and we launched with a series called The History of Israel Explained, which is exactly what you said. It's short, 10-minute, you know, jam-packed with information and lots of graphics, and it's fast and quick. And I think that our most popular video has been, you know, it's a funny thing to ask because it really is like some of the videos are growing quickly. Like we have one called The Weird Ways Israel Won Its War. And it's about the War of Independence. And it's, you know, it's growing pretty rapidly. The video on the Munich Massacre, the 1972 Olympics, is growing pretty rapidly. And there are a few others. I mean, they're 25, and so we're watching them carefully.
We will talk much more with Dina Rabban about Unpacked and the YouTube channel that can tell you everything you want to know about being Jewish, more or less, that you can't already learn on Too Jewish, when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish. Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates its first services, classes, and events this summer. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services Friday and Saturday, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha is currently located at 3001 East Skyline Boulevard on the northeast corner of Skyline and Campbell, just across from La Encantada. Services, classes, and events are open to all. Join us this Friday night at Skyline and Campbell for 5th of July Shabbat services at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning Torah studies at 9 a.m., followed by Shabbat morning services at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Join us for this final Shabbat at Skyline Drive next week, July 12th and 13th. We move to our new home at 2 Oracle Place, 7315 North Oracle Road, on the west side of Oracle, just north of Ina. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha to attend services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes program, and rich array of Summer Adult Education Academy courses, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org. That's BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me in the newest Jewish community in southern Arizona at its exciting beginning. We welcome back a randomly occurring two Jewish segment, our Zen Judaism. Three koans, or koans of wisdom, about our journey. The journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single oi. Be here now, be someplace else later. Is that so complicated? And wherever you go, there you are. Your luggage is another story. Three koans of Zen Judaism, moments of mystical peace here on Two Jewish. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, or downloading us at the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcast, Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So we're going to conclude this narrative of your extraordinary trip to Morocco and Spain, those extraordinary, the remarkable Jewish centers, with Seville, in the south of Spain.
Right. So Seville is a very big international business center, busy airport, connections to all over the world, and certainly larger than either Granada or Cordoba, although its Jewish history may be less rich. As a town, it's very important. It has not one, but two living Jewish communities, which have almost no connection with each other.
Sounds very Jewish.
Right. It is very Jewish. There's a small, kind of basically one-room Jewish museum that is run by the progressive or liberal Jewish community of Seville. And the person who greets you at the front door is a very gracious lady from Venezuela who speaks fluent English, Spanish, and God knows how many other languages. And she gave us a skinny on the liberal progressive community, which basically doesn't answer its emails because it felt like it was becoming a tourist attraction and there were more visitors than members of the local community. And they didn't want to feel like animals in a zoo. There are a few dozen, possibly as many as 90. There are kids who need to get a Jewish education and go to Jewish summer camp. They have no problem getting a minyan, but of course they count both men and women for that minyan. They include people from literally all over the world. The president of that community is a woman from Des Moines, Iowa, ironically. And they sort of badmouth the traditional or Orthodox Jewish community and are sort of dismissive about the fact that, well, the Orthodox never get a minyan. So what difference does it make if they're more religious? They're not in the cool part of town either. They're in a poorer part of town. We're in the part of town that feels at home to people like us. And what like us means is same-sex couples, single parents, a very mixed bag that represents, you know, the best
today,
of modern Jewry, but not necessarily the traditions of the most orthodox elements of the community. So most of my group, except for me, went to the liberal service on Friday night and had a very good time and interacted with many of them and set up a breakfast meeting on Sunday with one guy to talk about funding and, you know, getting them more attention throughout the world. On Saturday morning, a few of us went to the Orthodox Minyan, and there were seven guys there who ranged in age from maybe 40 to 80, and the fact that three North American males showed up gave them great joy because it meant that they could take out the Torah and do a Torah reading for the first time in months.
Wow.
And they fell over themselves thanking us for coming and making a minyan. And when one guy in our group wanted to go to the bathroom, they said, "Don't leave. We won't have a minyan." He said, "I'm just going to the bathroom."
Right.
There wasn't really a women's section in this small shul. There was like the last two rows, and there was a
kind of a
symbolic divide. Yeah, barely a mechitza,
right.
Kind of symbolic. And the only woman there was from our group.
Right.
So we found their service, while Sephardic, was much less foreign than the services in Morocco. Huh. It was more familiar and somehow more European. And they just couldn't thank us enough for being there. It was quite amazing. They are not well organized or well funded. Now, the most interesting thing to me was that the youngest guy in the Orthodox congregation was a man of roughly 40, plus or minus five, who is an OBGYN and works in the local hospital. He comes from Venezuela. He's only been in Sevilla for 2 months. And he doesn't know the Jewish lady from Venezuela who is the like receptionist at the Jewish Museum, because she belongs to
the
a different Jewish community that might as well be on another planet. So, you know, it was kind of interesting that the best and worst of world Jewry encapsulated right there.
Exemplified right there in Sevilla.
Right.
Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie New, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Abe is on his deathbed. He turns to his faithful wife, Sarah. "Sarah, Sarah," he says, "we've been married for 46 years. Isn't that right, Sarah?" "Of course, Abe, of course we have," Sarah replies. "When I was hit by that truck, when we first started dating," Abe says, "you were there for me, no?" "I never left your side in the hospital, darling," Sarah answers. "And when our house burned down right after we got married," Abe says, "we worked together, saved for years to build a new one, didn't we? And you were with me the whole way." "I was there, Abe," Sarah replies. "And when the IRS audited me from nowhere and we had to pay them a huge fine and we were broke for a long time, you were there," Abe says. "I was there, darling Abe," says Sarah. "And now on my deathbed, you are here with me yet again." "I am," Sarah replies. Abe turns to his wife and says, "Sarah, you're a terrible jinx." That was the old Jewish joke of the week. Special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well and don't be a jinx. We welcome our Shin Shiniot, our young representatives of Israel, Rotem Rappaport and Ron Benakot. Boker Tov and Mazal Tov.
Boker Tov, toda rabah.
Boker Tov, thank you.
So you guys are now Benot Mitzvah. You are now officially called to the Torah, something that really probably would never have happened in Israel. Tell us like what that experience was like for you now that this is past.
This experience was really exciting for me also because we're going to end our year soon, and that was a great way to end our year. It's a one-in-a-lifetime chance for me to do it because I probably wouldn't have done it in Israel, like you said. So I think that was like a great chance to do it and to see all the people from the community that I love come to celebrate with me, and for me to sum up all the things that I learned about the Jewish community in Tucson. So I think that was a great experience, and I'm so happy I did it.
And we will talk more about your observations about the Jewish community in Tucson, but Ron, tell us about your experiences.
So I was really nervous at first, but it was a lot of fun.
Just like a 13-year-old would be,
exactly.
To be honest.
Yep. But it was a lot of fun, and we got a lot of support, and it was really nice to see, really, like Rotem said, all the Jewish community just like gathers and come and support. That was really nice. And I also loved that they aired it so all of our family and friends in Israel could watch it.
Yeah, I put that in really that system nice. There actually years
yeah,
ago.
That was really nice.
So it's live video. You can see it HD.
Yeah, after the service, I can see all the texts from like my family, and they're like, oh, good luck. And I'm like, yeah, I can see it. But okay, thank you.
Nothing like live streaming things. It really changes it, especially, you know, from Israel. They could be there. Have you ever read from the Torah before? I mean, I don't mean practicing for this, but would you have ever read from the Torah?
I never read from the Torah.
Yeah, never. Maybe only like at school we had like a Bible class, like the Torah.
So you're learning Tanakh, but you're not reading from the actual
not
scroll,
really.
Right?
Oh, no.
No.
Which is
like a unique experience.
Now, if you had been boys, you would have read from the Torah, right?
Right.
So this is
our bar mitzvah in Israel.
Yeah. So maybe you should join a Reform congregation when you move back to Israel. I'm just saying.
We'll think about it. Definitely.
What was the biggest surprise in that experience?
I think just seeing all the people like coming to my bar mitzvah, because I thought that like maybe because it's in a certain congregation that maybe other people wouldn't come, not because of the congregation, because like there's so many people from so many different congregations that I worked with throughout the year, and right. I didn't know who would come and who not, and I saw so many people from so many different places just coming to like for us, and it was so exciting for me to see that
to see everybody come together for that.
Yes,
yeah, for
that's
Simcha.
What I was trying
for,
to
you
say.
Know, Simchas are supposed to bring people together.
Yeah.
Well, it's a great thing, and now you guys are officially benot mitzvah, and that makes you grown-ups.
Yay!
Woo!
We will talk more about your observations about your year here next week. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you.
And now a word of Torah. This week, our portion features drama and tragedy, rebellion and punishment. To recap last week's events, the people of Israel have come to the borders of the Promised Land just 2 years after leaving Egyptian slavery, but a team of spies comes back with a poor report. We aren't strong enough to conquer this land. Shocked, the Israelites rebel against the leadership of Moses and Aaron. The rebellion fails. A verdict is proclaimed. This lack of faith in God lies at the heart of the problem, and God decides this generation can never come into the Holy Land. They will have to live in the Sinai for 38 more years until they are all gone, and a new generation, fresh with the optimism of youth and untainted by slavery in its mentality, can come forward. Stung by this sentence of death in the desert, at the start of this week's portion, a group of rebels under the leadership of a priest, a Kohen named Korach, challenges the control of Moses and Aaron. He accuses them of chutzpah, of hubris, of overweening pride and egotism. Born into the same tribe, the Levites, Korach is an insider rebelling against his own kin. Who are these guys, Moses and Aaron, to take on the authority of ruling over us? Korach asks. His rebellion threatens the very foundation of Israelite leadership. For if the God of liberation is not at the heart of this enterprise, if it's all a matter of ego and self-aggrandizement, they might as well go back to Egypt and live in slavery, as some propose now to do. But Korach dissembles. That is, he lies. For Moses clearly has had no great desire for this high office, but he has held it as a sacred trust given him by God. Korach threatens God's authority, not Moses. Our Torah portion tells us that in order to determine the ongoing leadership, a great outdoor contest is held, a kind of religious challenge match. The net result is that Korach and his followers are completely destroyed. Moses and Aaron are fully vindicated. You know, it's nice when God has your back. One lesson of Korach is that before we accuse others of arrogance, we must look in the mirror. But the even more abiding lesson is that a Judaism that doesn't base itself in humility and reverence for God, and which is focused on personal aggrandizement, will fail. Only through faith and devotion can we reach our own promised land. In this new information age, the way people learn Judaism is changing rapidly, especially young people. Dina Rabban is the CEO of the new Jewish YouTube channel called Unpacked. They are not only doing something about it, they are making Judaism accessible and available for everybody in dynamic new ways. Find out how it works when we come back in a moment on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Percent of Americans think small business owners should be allowed to refuse service to Jews if doing so would violate their religious beliefs. So a new poll shows that's an increase from back in 2014, just 5 years ago, when only 12% of respondents agreed with that ridiculous statement. That's according to survey results published last week by the Public Religion Research Institute. The survey found increased support for business owners to refuse service to a number of other groups, too, including gays and lesbians, transgender people, atheists, Muslims, and African Americans. The proportion of Americans who think small businesses should be able to refuse service to gays and lesbians was highest among all the minority groups that were considered to be appropriate people to discriminate against. 30% of Americans think small businesses should be able to refuse service to gays and lesbians. Other groups ranged from just 15% to African Americans to 29% for transgender people. Jews, again, were 19%. A significantly higher proportion of Republicans approve of refusing service in all categories than Democrats do. 24% of Republicans thought small business owners should be allowed to refuse service to Jews based on religious grounds. 17% of all Democrats. There was no survey as to whether Republicans believed businesses should deny service to Democrats or Democrats believed that businesses should deny service to Republicans. It's a weird and disturbing trend. The idea that nearly one in five Americans think it's okay for businesses not to serve Jews on quote-unquote religious grounds is stunning. Of course, one in five Americans probably have watched Keeping Up with the Kardashians regularly, so that might not be something to get too worked up about. Still, on what conceivable basis could a business deny service to a Jew on religious grounds? Or for that matter, a Muslim, a Hindu, a Sikh, or a Buddhist, or a Christian. Wow, one in five. Weird and troubling. Last week, an 18-year-old hockey player, a wing named Jack Hughes, became the first Jewish player to be drafted number one overall by the National Hockey League, the NHL, the Major League of Hockey. The New Jersey Devils picked Hughes, a Florida native of all places who grew up in Ontario, Canada, as the overall number one. He's the son of a Jewish mother and Catholic father. Both of them were big-time hockey players themselves, who was bar mitzvahed 5 years ago. "We did Passover too," the teen phenom said during his interviews. Jack Hughes' older brother, Quinn Hughes, was the number seven pick a year ago by the Vancouver Canucks. Both were members of the U.S. squad in the Men's World Championship last month in Slovakia. They also have a 15-year-old brother, Luke, who looks like he's following in their footsteps. "Being chosen number one overall obviously is special, really exciting," said the young forward. In the recently completed season, Hughes broke the U.S. National Team Development Program record for points with 190. For Hughes and his brothers, the hockey lineage comes from their parents. His mother, the Jewish one, Ellen Weinberg Hughes, was a member of the U.S. women's national hockey team that won silver in the 1992 World Championships. His dad, Jim, played for Providence College and then became a coach and player development guy in the for the NHL's Boston Bruins and Toronto Maple Leafs. "It's in my blood to be an athlete, to be a hockey player," said Hughes. "My parents are having a ball with it." The Devils expect quite a bit from their top choice, the first Jewish guy ever selected as the overall number one pick in the NHL draft. And that's the Too Jewish News of Jews Round the World. We welcome back to Too Jewish our guest this morning, Dina Rabban. She's the CEO of a media company and the new Unpacked YouTube channel, which is at this moment, as we are interviewing her, up to 12,233 subscribers, according to YouTube, but growing fast. How do you decide How do you make the choices as to what kinds of videos you're going to create?
That's a really great question. You know, YouTube is a particular space. It's a platform that is not just a place to throw videos up onto. It's really driven by an algorithm and by search, which is why we make decisions driven by both our head of education, who helps us determine what is the right thing for us to be sharing and what would resonate and be relevant to our audience. At the same time, our marketing team and our film team looks carefully and sees what are people looking for, because the YouTube channel is really, it's a place that we want to make sure that when people are searching to learn about something, that there's a place that they'll find the information. So it's driven by both our educational vision and by search, by what we call keywording. We look and see what people are searching for, and then we want to make sure that we're there to meet them when they type in that search question.
You know, it's a funny thing. Obviously, we're driven by what the public is interested in, particularly if you have a target audience, you can identify that target audience. But still, you're coming from a perspective of presenting Jewish information in a positive way, including controversial areas. How do you ever find yourself being drawn to something that's controversial, but you might not want to address it?
That's a great question. If we're looking to be relevant and interesting to young audiences, then we can't be afraid of anything controversial, because we all know, I know that you have kids because I've listened to some of your other episodes.
Thank you.
I don't need to tell you what you already know.
Right.
Our young, you know, the millennials and the Gen Z, our young audiences, don't want people to shy away from the difficult topics. They're looking specifically for people who can speak to them honestly, courageously, without the concern for politics or saying things the right way. They just want the truth, and they want, they like it to be shared in a way that's non-ideologically driven and non-prescriptive. They don't want to be told how to think. They want to be given the opportunity to unpack ideas and to be able to come to their own conclusions and their own decisions. And that's what we're trying to offer. And we're always struggling to figure out how to manage some of the more complex topics and controversial issues, but we're not shying away from them.
In this history of Israel, it's no surprise to me, I'm just looking at some of the stats on your website and on the YouTube channel, it's no surprise to me that the Balfour Declaration has not garnered as many hits as, say, why did Israel go to war, the Six-Day War, or something like that. And yet you're covering it. Do you cover things as thoroughly as you can, even if you know that the audience won't be the same?
Yeah, I mean, we made our decisions based on, you know, really seeing what people are searching for and also what we think is important to share. But I think what's tricky is that we're really new. When you look at our channel, you know, we're in the infant stage of development. And the way that YouTube works, it's an incredible platform, but you need a lot of patience, because even if there's a video that has, you know, 5,000 views or even less than that, we're only in the first few months of launching this. And what happens with channels is that if you do it right, and if you follow the rules of YouTube, and if you create compelling content, then over time, your audience grows, and the algorithm on YouTube helps support your content. And so what can take a little bit of time, you know, it's like a slow gain, but eventually you hit a tipping point. And at that point in time, your videos, you know, can really explode in viewer growth. So what you're seeing now, maybe in a year we'll talk, Rabbi, and then hopefully in a year you'll say, oh, I remember when you only had 12,000 subscribers and, you know, your videos had lower views. And hopefully once we have more content and the algorithm likes us more, and people learn about us because we get to go on shows like yours, then we'll be seeing very different things. Even though the Balfour Declaration might not be so popular now, I'm going to withhold any judgment for a little while we build the channel.
A CEO kind of question. So two aspects of this, I think, are really particularly interesting. One is explaining this to people who, because you have to have funding, right? And it has to come from people who may or may not understand the technology terribly well. And then being in Israel, where everybody's used to things happening at an unbelievably fast rate, when this is kind of a growing piece, you know, you don't automatically go viral with something that you're trying to build some sustainability in. How do you explain to those two kinds of funders how this works?
So I want to make sure that I heard you correctly. One is the media landscape is unfamiliar to the traditional Jewish philanthropist.
Absolutely.
That's number one.
That's the first question.
And number two is, how we can encourage people to be patient, because whereas some nonprofits offer program delivery and you can see immediate results for whatever you're doing, this is a long game. A media channel requires a long game and a hefty dose of patience. Is that what you were asking?
That is indeed, and you put it far better than I did. So yes, both questions.
Well, I probably put it better because it's something that we are addressing regularly as we communicate and cultivate the larger Jewish community to understand the opportunity that we have. And it is entirely unfamiliar to the Jewish community. But remember, YouTube has been growing and exploding in the educational arena for a decade. So this is not something that we're pioneering. What we're pioneering, and I wouldn't say exclusively because we have, you know, some colleagues in the field, but what we're pioneering along with a few other people is what has already been done for years before us. And what we do is we try to create something that can fit into people's constructs in their brains. People, as soon as I start talking to anybody, it doesn't matter how old they are, and we talk about the power of media, everybody's nodding their heads. What may have been different even 5 years ago is just not everybody uses as a primary source of learning, news, reading, information, podcasting, all of it. And so the donor community, while they may not understand the algorithm of YouTube, which is something that I had to learn about when I started this work, they really do understand the power of media and the importance of media. And so it's just a matter of helping to attach that to something that they're familiar with already in their brain. And what we know is that the Jewish community cares deeply about Jewish continuity. They care deeply about Jewish education. They are often enamored and often committed to innovation and trying to find ways to better serve young people. And everybody understands that media is playing such a primary role in young people's lives. And so we're able to tell a narrative that most people, you know, as soon as we start talking, start nodding their heads and really start understanding that this is an opportunity that's really unparalleled in Jewish history. It's an opportunity to educate and to reach and teach everyone with practically no barriers to entry. And that's something that's never been true in the Jewish community. So it's a very exciting time. And with regards to patients, it's something we struggle with. And it's something that we're, you know, luckily as a media company, our YouTube channel, Unpacked, is not the only work that we do. We do other work as well. And so I think we're able to inspire enough confidence and to demonstrate enough impact with this and other work to help people stick around to want to see the long game.
Where do you see the company, where do you see this channel in particular, Unpacked, in a year? How many subscribers are you, say, shooting for?
Or
is that secret? Is that proprietary information?
It's not proprietary. It's funny because I learn a lot from other media companies, and they're very careful not to share what their projections are. And I'm sure you can understand why, always concerned that we're going to meet the projections. I would say that, you know, we're looking to grow. We understand that with the media channel, it's going to take time for it to grow. So by the end of 2019, we're looking to be at about 15,000 subscribers, so another couple thousand subscribers. And then we're hoping that as the algorithm works for us, we'll be able to double our subscribers and then hit that tipping point where we'll be doing much more than doubling our subscribers. But I think what's important to note is that we're looking to build a library of content where that will, you know, just continue to grow and be available. It's this incredible, something that we love to share with our supporters is that content doesn't go away. It builds and grows. And so we are creating 55 episodes of The History of Israel Explained in this year, 2019, but we expect it to grow over the next 5 to 7 years. And so that's what, you know, what we're seeing when we think of Unpacked. We launched one series and we're going to be launching another 2 to 3 series in the next year and a half. One's going to be on Jewish history, the entire Jewish history based on a book by Sir Martin Gilbert.
Yeah.
We're launching another series on Israeli culture and cuisine with Chloe Valdry, a dear friend of ours. We're going to be launching an explainer series, which is modeled after Vox and the explainer videos that Vox offers. Not exactly like them, but we're learning from them. And then we are in the middle, our head of education is in the middle of developing a giant content map where we're going to hopefully be creating, you know, dozens more series that will be all around things related to Jewish, to Israel, and to anything that a young Jew might be curious about to better understand themselves, their heritage, their history, their culture, and how they fit into this world.
I want to say I plan on using some of these in some classes I'm teaching to teens in the fall, which I hope is not only okay, but a good thing. And I think you're doing something that's going to be an incredible resource. I want to thank Dina Ravon for a great visit. People can go to the YouTube channel itself. You can search Unpacked. Any place else they should go to find out more about you guys?
So, you know, they can go to unpacked.com, which is our website. And we also recently launched a campaign. If you go to unpacked.media/take-10, you can actually sign up with your email and receive the weekly YouTube video right into your inbox. And it's a fun campaign that we're doing where we're telling everyone, if you just take 10 minutes a week, it's 10 minutes on your way to 10,000 hours of expertise, and gives you a really great opportunity to learn about Israel and the history of modern Israel. And and that's available. So you can go to the YouTube channel. You can find us on, just look up Unpacked on YouTube, or you can go to our website, unpacked.com, or you can go to unpacked.media/take-10, and you can sign up and get a video every week and become an expert in the history of Israel.
Dina, thank you so much. And it'll make you, if you do all this, it'll make you a better person and a better Jew both. So you have our endorsement. Thanks so much, Dina.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball. Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday on Too Jewish. Our guest will be Rabbi Herb Fried, the Renaissance rabbi, author of the books Beshert and Love, Faith, and A Pair of Pants. Our playout this morning comes from Mandy Patinkin and his Yiddish version of Irving Berlin's God Bless America for the coming 4th of July weekend. My friends, may you be blessed with a great and safe 4th of July, a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Sponsored by Two Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona.